I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your semi-professional reader wrangler, telling you who alphabetizes their shelves and who spills jam on their pages. I'm also the author of the memoir, The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shaped Me, which is published by Headline on the 7th of March. And I have a special discount for listeners because I love you too. Order from themargatebookshop.com and use code BOOKED for 20% off. This week, we have a very special guest and an episode with a difference. This is a conversation I had with the multi-million book bestseller, The Marie Kondo of Feelings, Sarah Knight. Sarah is the celebrated author of The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck, and she changed her life by moving to the Dominican Republic. Sadly, I could not afford to go to the Dominican Republic because I spent all my money on library fines, so I caught up with Sarah in Foyle's bookshop during her UK tour for her brilliant new book, Calm the Fuck Down, in which Sarah uses her trademark wit, wisdom and compassion to give us the tools we need to negotiate living in an age of anxiety. Before she became a writer, Sarah was a professional reader, working as a top editor and being one of the first to discover hits like Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl and Jessica Knowles' The Luckiest Girl Alive. She has a profound understanding of fiction, of writing and of readers. She is foul-mouthed, funny and fabulous. And as I interviewed her for some of her live events, I got to spend two whole days falling in love with her. I'm sure it goes without saying that this episode is on the sweary side. Here's my conversation with Sarah. I really wanted to ask you about a book that I understand, if my research is correct, that you edited, that I really, really adored, that did phenomenally well in the US, The Luckiest Girl Alive by Jessica Knoll. I loved that book.
I was reading it on a Friday afternoon. Her agent sent it to me, and I knew just on the subway ride on my way home, I said, this is it. She's my next Gillian Flynn, because I had edited Gillian's second novel and acquired Gone Girl before I left publishing, and then went to, or before I left that publishing office and went to another company. And it took 4 years before I got something come across the transom that I said, okay, this is going to be a big one. This I love. And so I finished it, and I immediately came in and said, I have to buy this. I have to, you know, we must acquire it for, it doesn't matter how much we must spend. And met a little bit of resistance, as one often does in a publishing company when anybody wants to spend a lot of money, but eventually did grab it from the jaws of another interested editor who actually used to be my assistant and was sort of my protege, if that doesn't sound condescending. Like, she was like my mini-me in the best possible way, and I just loved her, and she was totally on the other end of the auction, and we didn't know it until
it absolutely it was over. Sounds like there needs to be a novel of this. Novel acquiring. That sounds great. So I have many things to ask you about that. Firstly, Gillian Flynn. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. So were you...
So I did not discover her. Her first novel, Sharp Objects, was acquired by an editor named Sally Kim, the other SK in publishing. It's actually me, Sally Kim, and Stephen King. obviously, one of those people is way more important than the others. I'll let you decide who. And Sally published Sharp Objects, and then she left for a different job, and I moved into her position, and Gillian delivered what became Dark Places. So I edited that novel with her from beginning to end, published it, was there for the publication, did really well, we were very happy. And then right around the time I was leaving, she submitted a treatment for Gone Girl. It was probably like 30 pages and sort of a, here's how it's going to start and here's what's going to happen, you know, here's the twist and here's where it's going to end up. And I just remember thinking, wow, I wonder how she's going to pull that off, you know, because it seemed really ambitious, but I had a lot of confidence in her and she was a very important member of the roster at that particular publisher. And so I did have the opportunity to acquire that book with her, and then I left before it was ever written, so I cannot take any credit for being its editor. I merely ushered it onto my desk and then had to say, wave a very sad goodbye to it and all of the success. I did, yes.
Instrumental in it.
I was rather the midwife.
Coming into the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing you're one of the very first people to see what it was going to become.
I knew what it was going to be, but you know, the very special twists that people don't see coming and whatever, just because she laid it out. But also I read it in its galley form because she or her agent or somebody shared it with me, and I read it on a plane. And when I read that book, it was the same feeling that I had, you know, 4 or 5 years later with Jessica Knoll, where I walked into my new boss's office with Gillian's arc that was no longer, you know, that was not being published by us. And I said, this is going to be the book of the year. I just finished it. Wow. And that happened. So maybe I'm a wizard. I don't know.
You have powers.
No, obviously I don't, because there were other books that I thought were going to be the book of the year that weren't. So, you know.
How did your relationship with reading change when you were working? I know you've spoken about how glad you are to not be in that industry anymore in that way. I guess you're still very much in that industry, but at a very different end of it. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to make you relive times of your life that you didn't enjoy, but did you read for pleasure when you were doing that job, or were you reading for work so much that it wasn't possible?
Barely. I was barely able to read for pleasure. I was such a prolific reader as a little kid and a young adult, and I went to college and I got my degree in English literature and American literature, and so I read certainly, you know, for school. And once I started working in publishing, I just didn't have the time to read. Everything was pleasurable, but to read things outside of the auspices of work. So I would get, you know, by the time I was done, I was getting probably, I don't know, at least 5 or 6 submissions a day of both fiction and nonfiction. So call that conservatively 25 submissions a week that I had to stay on top of, read, digest, figure out whether I wanted to pursue them or not, respond to them in some way or the other, plus working on the edits of the books that I had already acquired. And I usually did, I would say, anywhere between 3 and 6 passes on a book, depending on how much work it needed, whether things sort of changed along the way, especially with nonfiction books. They often develop a lot differently than the original proposal. So I did not have a lot of time to keep up with the books that were coming out during that span. And now I have been able to go back and really just read things that everybody else was reading 10 years ago. But at least I'm getting there. At least I'm there now.
I do think it's interesting how with books, there does seem to be a bit of a pressure to be reading the book of the moment. There's always something hot. And I think it's the same with a lot of the culture that is around us and the way we consume it. And I don't know whether things like Netflix have sort of exacerbated that. You must read it and you must read it now. Whereas, you know, books are broadly, I think, not immune to trends exactly, but they will still be there now and in 10 years and 100 years to go and 100 years to come with any luck.
Yeah, and actually one of the books I read recently that I just loved was by an author called Marag Joss. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it was called Half Broken Things, and I think it came out 15 years ago. But I happened to be on Twitter saying, you know, I have some travel coming up. I'm looking for a great suspense or thriller. Let me know. And Sophie Hanna, who's one of my favorite writers, whose own novels of suspense I have loved, said, you have to read this. It is a classic. It's flawless. There's nothing wrong with it. And it's an old book and nobody knows about it. And you should go get it. And I did. And she was right. It was brilliant. So I think that's more to the point of it's okay if I missed something a few years ago. It'll still be there. Hopefully it hasn't been pulped. But I do primarily read on a Kindle these days, with my apologies to independent booksellers and bricks and mortar bookstores. I live in the Dominican Republic and I can't get books there.
You kind of come read your books before she told us to the outrage of the internet.
Yes, so it was around 2007, and I had gotten married, and all of our wedding gifts were in storage because we knew we were going to be moving into our first real adult apartment. And so I had...
Still in New York.
This was in New York, yes. We were living in Brooklyn. And I was working in publishing, and I had a lot of colleagues who were younger than me. You know, if I was an editor at the time, they were editorial assistants. And they all love books, and they love free books, and that's one of the only perks. And so one night, because I had to move, and I didn't want to have to pack all these books, and I had the IKEA shelves. They're called the LAC shelves, and they're 6 feet long, and they're floating shelves, and I had five of them. So I had 30 feet, if I'm doing the math right, of books. And I said, come to my apartment for beer and chips and salsa and guacamole, and leave with no fewer than three of my books. You are required to take books with you. And I had coffee table art books. I had the, 1001 Guide to Astrologist, whatevers. I had all kinds of cool books that I had collected as a young editorial assistant who brought home free books from the office for years and years. And I had picked out like the six or seven that I wanted to hold on to, and then they cleared me out. They must have each taken 10. And they were so excited. Oh, you have this? Are you really willing to part with this? Yes, I really am. I don't want to have to pack it in a box. I don't want to have to unpack it. I don't want to fill my new shelves at my new house. So I did that a really long time ago, and I never looked back. I really didn't acquire. If I bought a book, I gave it away when I was done with it. And like I said, I've migrated to e-reading because then I can have a lot of books all at once, but they're not crapping up my home.
What were the books you kept? Can you remember? Do you still have them?
Well, I've ended up now with one, which is a mass market edition of A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving, which is my favorite novel. And when I read it, it was just this, little mass market paperback that had probably been purchased at the grocery store. And over time and over moving it to college and moving it to New York and moving through five apartments in New York, it had gotten really, really, really beat up and yellowed and kind of falling apart. And when I worked at Simon & Schuster still a few years ago, my boss acquired John Irving's two new books, so stole him away from Random House where he had been before. And so he came into the office, and my boss said, I know you're a big fan. Would you like to meet John Irving? And, I really would. That would be so cool. And so I had my little Owen Meany paperback with me. And it was kind of a group meeting with two other editors who really liked him. And we just, it was a chill sort of 15-minute conversation, and we were trying not to be super fans or anything. And I stood up, and I had the book in my hand, and he came around the coffee table of my boss's office and said, would you like me to, may I sign your book? So it was like this really like gentlemanly, like he didn't want to be like, obviously you want me to sign it. He's like, would you like me? No. May I sign your book? And I was like, yes, you can.
That's so gracious.
And apparently he doesn't do a lot of signings anymore because he has terrible, I don't know if it's arthritis or he just has, there's something wrong with his hands. And so he really does not do, he doesn't sit down and sign hundreds of books at a time. And he really doesn't like to have to do that. So I didn't want to push. And yeah, he did that, and so he signed it, and so that is the single book that I currently have on my shelves that is not one of my books, because I have all of the foreign editions, one copy each of every foreign edition of my books, which is now way too many, and then there's too many of them, and I need to get rid of them.
How many feet of shelves is that?
We're probably looking at maybe 20 feet of shelves, two long 10-foot shelves, and they're starting to get really overrun, I feel, with my books.
With Kindle reading, do you look for books that you know you want already, or do you do much browsing? Is there anything that you're looking for when you're thinking about what to read next?
So usually what I do, and this is a great feature of Kindle, I have to admit, again, not to the detriment of real live books, is that if you know there's something you want to read, you can download a sample for free for most books. And then you have it in your queue, so you're always reminded, like, if I like that, I can buy the book. So it's sort of like I have a reading backlog, like, to-do list for my reading And I just download samples as I hear about a book that sounds good or whatever. And then I pick from there, depending on what I'm in the mood for.
What's the first book you remember reading and absolutely losing yourself in?
Well, the very first book I ever read was called Go Dog Go. And
sounds great.
And my mom was really surprised because I was very, very young, like very young. And I came downstairs and I said, "What sound does C make?" And she said, "Kuh." And I said, "Okay, I can read this book now." She was like, "Sure you can." And I sat down with Go Dog Go and I read it out loud. Sorry, I got a little quiet there. I read it out loud and my mother was very impressed and excited. So that was the beginning of the voracious, you know, of the voracious reading. And then there were a lot of things I just read so widely when I was a kid. You know, I read Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And I read things that, A Civil Action, which made me think that I wanted to be a lawyer. But then I was also reading The Complete Jane Eyre. I just started at the beginning and just kept reading them because it seemed that that was something that I should read, but I also was really enjoying it.
When you say The Complete Jane Eyre, you mean the Bronte
book? The Complete Jane Austen. The Complete Jane Eyre, the full book, all 385 pages.
Not abridged. I did think possibly Jane Austen, but I thought...
No. The Complete Jane Austen, all of them.
Is there a sequel to Jane?
Pride and Prejudice, all of them. I read a lot of Shakespeare on my own. I was really interested in Shakespeare. I was really interested in language. It's part of the reason that I went on to major in English because I just...
What was it about Shakespeare that appealed to you? Because there's so much. Was it like the grand stories or the jokes?
It was really the wordplay, the language, the rhythm of it. There's a little bit of filthy naughtiness, you know, to be had also. And I moved on to really liking Nabokov for a lot of the same reasons of wordplay. And just to me, language is a very fascinating thing, and the way it has evolved, you know, over time, and how certain things still mean what they always did, and certain letters and word and combinations of letters sound the same as they always did, and some things have changed radically, and it's just very interesting. Like last night, I said it was my book launch party, and I said I felt so fetid, and my editor kind of blinked at me, and I said not fetid, but rather fetid, having been at a fete. And celebrated. She was like, right, okay.
The accent, what's it called? Circumflex.
Yes. So so I really like authors who play around with language, and that's always been one of my go-tos.
Because I know something that you do in your books that I love is there'll be a joke that's sort of referred to and that, you know, lovely kind of Easter egg treat. Like, that's my reward for paying attention. And I think what's so nice about having that Shakespeare in you and, you know, embracing it from the start as you see so many other writers doing it and making references, and you're being rewarded all day long with all these nods.
Yes, it's true. I think reading is very fun. It was always a really fun thing for me. And as we talked about, you know, when I had to do it, not had to do it, when I chose to do it and loved doing it as a profession, I did lose some of the pleasure and the joy because... I don't know, I was a little resentful that I couldn't just drop everything and read something that I wanted that I didn't happen to be publishing.
I think when you feel like you're reading to a deadline and, like, you know, whether or not you're enjoying it, you have to do it, I think it's very difficult to keep the pleasure there.
Yeah, and as a kid, I read all the time. My husband has a much less, slimmer background in sort of what I would call the classics, you know, the Tom Sawyer and just stuff that I thought he might have read as a kid. And he said, "Well, I had friends and I was outside playing soccer." And, you know, I was like, "Well, I was always in my room reading. I was sitting on the couch reading. I was in the car reading." Because I just took so much joy in it.
Do you and your husband ever read things together, or do you recommend things to each other, or pass things around?
Only in the last, I would say, maybe 5 years has he become a real reader, and then he has really embraced it and become a voracious reader. So I've suggested things. I've purchased books for him as gifts. He has suggested a couple of things to me, but I've read a lot more, so it's not... There aren't a lot of things he's read that I haven't, or if he's read them, it's because they were of interest to him, and the reason I haven't read them is because they're not of interest to me. But he actually did just turn me on to Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, which was... huge in, what, 2000 and 2007 or 2008-ish.
I don't know that book at all. Is that a crime book?
It's true crime, but it's also history. He's a historian. He's written probably six fairly best-selling books, but that was a big breakout, and it's about the Chicago World's Fair in whatever year that was. It was a really long time ago, and it coincided with the first known serial killer who was operating in America, and it was just around the time of Jack the Ripper here, and so people were they were hearing tell of that, and it was like, how could that happen on our own shores? And it was this really fascinating just history of two big events that wound up intertwined with one another, and it was great. And he was like, I told you you'd love it. I was like, and I did, and I'm sorry I didn't read it when it came out. I certainly knew about it, and I just never got to it. So he definitely recommended one of my most recent reads.
But it was there waiting for you. And also, I think really, if you'd read it when it came out, then you wouldn't have had that lovely moment of him suggesting something.
Yes.
And being in that unusual position where he could, you know, have an idea.
I think he was rather pleased that he had suggested something that I liked so much.
How good are you at guessing people's tastes? I'm going to say probably very good in your experience as an editor. Did you sort of think of like, well, I'm not sure this is for me, but it is definitely for people? Or did you have something in your gut that said yay or nay?
So I'm very good at recommending books to people if they tell me what they like. It turns out I'm not as good at intuiting what you might like just upon meeting you. And so I've had some misses, especially with a friend of mine who shall remain nameless. And I said, well, you won't tell me what you like. You just said anything. Pick anything. I'm like, well, this book is really hot right now, and I know that you like smart literature, so I think you might like it. And then she's like, well, I don't like books where children die. And I'm like, well, okay, that cuts out a lot of thrillers, a lot of suspense, okay. You know, so in that sense, like, I'm pretty good if I can tailor it, if I know what you like. But as an editor, you spend the early part of your career doing whatever you're told. Then you try to assert your independence and your autonomy and choose books to acquire that you like, but that also you think will do well. And the older you get, or the more advanced in your career you get, usually you're rewarded by being able to make some decisions about the direction of your list that, for me at least, I enjoyed actually really great, especially my last 5 years at Simon & Schuster. I did a wide variety of books, and they were really all reflective of things I liked and I was interested in, messages I wanted to get across. And that was really rewarding, and it was part of the job that was hard to say goodbye to.
I really loved a piece you wrote that I think is a Medium about how to survive and enjoy the process of publishing a book. And I wish I'd had it in my life before, but I've read it and I'm going to be rereading it a lot. I guess the funny thing about books, whether you're publishing them or writing them, is you want to have control, and you have so little control. And I guess that the books that you write generally are about, you know, it's the one question to rule them all,
right?
Can I control it? Uh-huh. And that, no, you can't.
That article was intended to be delivered from the dual perspective of somebody who has been on the editing and publishing side of the book process and now is on the author side. And what I really wanted to get across was to prospective authors, don't lose your mind, especially don't alienate the people who are helping you and whose goodwill you need in order to recover from whatever bad thing might have happened, because lots of bad things will happen. Book publishing is impossible to predict. It's impossible to control. There are things like just the whim of the consumer, but then there are also, you know, snowstorms that blow through and cancel your book tour. And so there are going to be all of these, and, you know, maybe you like the cover, but you hate the font, or maybe your editor tells you at the last minute that you need to fill 20 more pages at the back of the book, which happened to me. And you're not going to be able to control all or certainly most of them. And so I wanted people to be prepared for that, because I always think it's good to manage expectations. Just in my life, I like to manage expectations. And to say the very first tip to lead with something positive is enjoy the good parts. Enjoy the fact that you sold your book, or that you've gotten off your ass to self-publish your book. Enjoy the fact that more people will be reading your work. You know, get excited about the fact that you can talk about your book now in conversation, and it's a real thing. Because there will be low points, and you will have to deal with them. And coming from the perspective of an editor, it's just as hard for an editor or a publicist to deliver bad news to their author as it is for the author to hear it. You know, my publicist created this amazing campaign, balls to the wall, just packed full of events and interviews and things, but we are in London. It is January. Many things could go wrong, weather, other guests being booked, you know, being late in traffic, whatever it is. And I would feel, because I've known how it was to work on that side of the industry, just as bad for her if a day's worth of bookings got screwed up. Like, I would feel bad for me. I would feel a little sorry for myself because that's, you know, publicity lost and potentially sales. But that's so much work on the side of your publishers. And they also are invested in the books doing well. So I wanted people to go in with that perspective in mind so that they could not be allowed to swear on your podcast.
Oh, yeah.
So they could not be assholes to the people who are working really hard on their behalf.
With you especially, I think the swearing was a given. I think I'd be disappointed if you didn't.
I could start really just getting to it now. You know, I've been holding back.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
We'll be back with Sarah soon, but now I want to tell you about my steal of the week, a book I loved so much that paying the cover price alone feels a bit like shoplifting, and I want to run back and put another 20 quid in the till. This week's steal is Emma Morgan's A Love Story for Bewildered Girls, published by Viking. It's the story of three women, Grace, Annie and Violet, and how they deal with the vulnerability and indignity of love. It's told with great tenderness, and it is exquisitely and delicately observed. It's Morgan's debut, and her voice is absolutely her own, but she reminded me of Muriel Spark at her very best with a gentle whisper of Alan Bennett. I'm going to give this to everyone I know who loved The Girls of Slender Means or The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. That's A Love Story for Bewildered Girls, published by Viking and out now by Emma Morgan. Now back to Sarah. With the life-changing magic of not giving a fuck, did you go in thinking that you had perhaps a better steer on what to expect because of that being on the other end? And was there anything that surprised you, or do you think that you had kind of the wherewithal to deal with all those highs and lows because you'd been on all the ends?
I went in expecting very little because my knowledge of the industry was such that I know, you know, most books don't succeed or take off, even the great ones. There are a lot of bad ones do succeed and take off, and it's all very subjective anyway. So it's really, to me, I forced myself not to have particularly high expectations. I controlled what I could, which was, you know, having a good idea and I think executing it well, particularly on a short timeline. And then it was up to not just my publishing team, but also I had some, you know, there was some responsibility on my end to try to market myself effectively and think of ways to get the book, you know, into the conversation. But eventually it was just not in my control and I did not have particularly high expectations. Mostly because I don't like to be disappointed. So I'm a pessimist. Like I like to keep it, you know, manageable. And then when it did take off and it was clear that it was taking off, that's when it got to be much more pressure, because it was like, oh, well, I'm probably going to have to do this again. And can I do it? Can we recreate this? The answer is never. You never know. If you could recreate it, we'd do it all the time. So there was, yeah, I didn't have any expectations. And
because the impression I get from your books as well, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the thing you'd most like to be doing is, yeah, lying on a sofa in your home, eating Doritos, and everything else is to get you back to that point.
Yes. Prone on a lounge chair in the sun with the Doritos and an Aperol spritz, that is what I would like to be doing. And my husband says that the reason that I like to sunbathe is because I'm actually accomplishing something. I am getting tan, because otherwise he thinks that I'm not capable of just relaxing and not doing anything, and he might be right. But I do, you know, I made this big move. I left New York City. I left my very secure, or as secure as a job in media can be, I suppose, and a lot of successes. And I did that because I was so unhappy, and I was so just strung out every day on my unhappiness. And so I've made these changes, and those are going really well, and I would like to keep up with them. So, you know, there has been some discussion of whether I should be doing a tidy up your mind show the way Marie Kondo is tidying up your house. And I don't, if that means I have to go live in somewhere, New York or LA, for 4 months to film a show and be working 12 hours a day and be away from my husband and my feral cats, then I don't really want to do that right now. I mean, it's possible that somebody could twist my arm, but no, I do want to be on my lounge chair with my Doritos.
I do think part of your whole ethos is about island life, and I love it when you write about learning to embrace the fact that, again, lots of stuff is out of your control, and the internet is patchy, and the weather means that you're on its schedule rather than the other way around. So I think if you brought the contestants out to the Dominican Republic, I volunteer as a tribute.
Excellent. I will remember
I think
that.
Then the show could work.
Yeah. No, I think they would also have to endure some enforced tranquility like I have, because things would not go according to plan. There's also a lot of neighbors, and our house is not really particularly well sealed. There's a lot of open doors and screens and, you know, a lovely airflow, but also sometimes very loud music or loud splashing children and lots of different languages being spoken all times of the night and day. So it can get, between that and the frogs, it can get a little bit cacophonous, especially in the more busy times. And so when I record podcasts from my little desk upstairs, which is about the quietest part of the house, I'm no match for shouting neighbors, children saying, you know, Mira, Mira, Mommy, Mira. And also once the frogs start, I can't really do anything after dark because they're so loud that...
Are they like the Budweiser frogs?
They're not like a low, like, ribbit. They're like peepers. They're like tinkly and like very loud and whistly.
Like crickety frogs.
I don't think I knew that they were capable of doing that. They're tiny also. They make so much noise, but you go outside and you're like, where is that frog? And it's this tiny little frog the size of my little knuckle here.
I wanted to ask you about the pressures of reading. And I guess you obviously had this a lot in your job because it was your job. But I do think that reading is something that's becoming a little bit performative. And I think that especially, you know, anyone who uses social media a lot, there's a real, oh, you should be reading this now. There's a quote-unquote big book. Mm-hmm. It's got to be on the list. Obviously, everything that you're about is about taking away that should and that sense of doing anything that you feel obliged to do rather than wanting to do it. If you were to write a no-fucks-given guide on how to read for you, what would you put in it?
Well, I would certainly never finish a book that I didn't like. I mean, that is the number one rule for me, is don't waste time. Life is too short to finish books that you don't like. And I have a friend, a very dear friend, who will hate read a book to its very end because she just can't leave it unfinished. And she feels bad that she paid money for the book and she's not finishing it. She's not consuming the product. She wants to make sure she's right about hating it so that if she ever has to talk to somebody about it, she won't be like, well, I didn't finish it, and have them be like, oh, you didn't finish it? Then how dare you talk shit about it? But I just do not have the patience for books that I don't like. Now, on the other hand, I'm also very friendly with a lot of people in publishing, both in the US and the UK. so, and I'm on social media really regularly, and I like to shout about the things that I like because I always know it's good to amplify authors. It's really nice when somebody can do that for you. But I don't talk about books that I don't like because I know, first of all, I know it hurts personally now, having had bad reviews from Amazon customers. I'm like, oh God, ooh, that makes me feel bad about myself, even though I don't agree with them.
It's so funny now, because obviously I read it and like, I know how many books you've sold. Can I say it? Sure. Is it, am I right? Is it 2.5 million altogether worldwide? And 250,000 copies of The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck just here in the UK, yes, which is... And if you sort of add it all over, I think, does that mean like everybody in the world probably has like 10 copies each?
Probably.
So that, there are going to surely be, I can say this very easily, there are going to be a couple of terrible, terrible idiots who are like, it came a day late, 1 star. Exactly. But I know that having been on the end of
it. 1 star. Well,
it's on the clue was on the cover.
Right.
But I've had enough mean Amazon reviews to, I could quote them to you now. I won't, but it's...
I try very stinks. Hard if I come across them. Sometimes I'm looking at the page because I'm trying to change the, you know, I'm sending my editor like, oh, we should have moved this quote up on the feed. And so I see them and I try really hard to like not engage. Now, every once in a while I want to have an example of a truly vicious review so that I can make fun of it and write about it in one of my books. So there was this woman, Amelia, who reviewed one of my books on Amazon, who was really vicious. She apparently thinks I am a terrible person. So I do remember that one. But what I was going to say is that I am so familiar with and friendly with so many people who have the part in writing any particular book that if I read something that I don't love, I don't really want to offend its editor, its publicist. Possibly I know the writer, or maybe I know the writer's spouse, but I don't know they're married. And I don't really want to drop that in their laps because I know that it just feels bad when people review things badly. So I really only post about things I like. And the problem with that is that occasionally I will post a book that I'm starting to read that I'm really excited about, and then I finish it, or I don't finish it, and I'm like, oh, that wasn't very good. And then I feel like I've set up this expectation because maybe I've tagged the author, I've tagged the publisher or something, and they're like waiting for me to say I love it, and I don't. So I just sort of try to let those go.
It's just like when your friends are in a terrible play and all you can say at the end is like, you've done it again!
Oh, so my husband went to NYU for musical theater, to the Tisch School for Musical Theater. Very prestigious program, and a lot of he didn't end up pursuing it as a life career, but a lot of our friends are on Broadway, whether they're directing, they're in the band, you know, the orchestra, or they're on stage. And so a lot of them are on Facebook with me. And I learned the hard way that when theater people gush about their friends' shows, you can't trust it. Because I bought tickets for a show, and I won't say what it was. It's not on Broadway anymore, so you can't possibly be bamboozled like I was. And I just thought it was going to be great because I had all these people, oh, congratulating so-and-so who was in it. Somebody did the hair for it. And it was horrendous. And that was not me not liking it. Like, it was objectively bad. And I was like, but everybody said it was so good. And then I realized that it's just a bunch of people, you know, fluffing each other up, which is a lovely thing to do for your friends. But anyway, so yeah, you have to look for where your recommendations come from. And
I guess what's nice about the book is it's a limited time and money commitment compared with buying a theatre ticket and sitting through.
Well, certainly that was a much more expensive endeavour.
I think it's interesting too that you talked about social media and the idea there are, you know, some expectations of you as an author and an advice giver. And I know that you get asked a lot of advice from your readers on the internet. And I do sometimes get the impression it's that, you know, I have a question for you that's more of a statement. Mm-hmm. And people who won't necessarily be there to hear the practical advice that you're able to give them. How do you deal with that? Does it ever frustrate you, or have you got quite good at just managing that and accepting that's the way people are?
I pretty much accept that that's the way people are. I mean, I run through a few different types of reactions in my own head, depending on what kind of comments I'm getting. Sometimes it's the question that's not really a question, it's just a comment, and I'm like, okay, well, this is what you want to post on my Instagram, and that's fine. Sometimes it's people basically asking me to make my advice different or easier for them to follow. And I'm like, may I refer you to my second book, Get Your Shit Together? Because, you know, I'm like, okay, well, I'm not rewriting it for you. I'm sorry that you would like it to be delivered in a slightly different way. And sometimes people are a real mess and they write to me with just a bevy of problems and they sound like they really need help, possibly more professional medical help, but also just like they're just a disaster and I'm really sorry, but I'm not here to spend like an hour or two of my evening counseling you on all of these problems that you have laid at my doorstep. So sometimes I have to be judicious in my responding. I do read all of the emails that come to me. So if you've emailed me, I have seen it. I try to respond. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes it's very brief. But I do try to respond, unless you're being nasty, in which case.
I guess as well, people ask me for advice. And it's, I think, very good of you not to say, like, well, yes, my advice is all in the books. You right. can go and get one of those.
I advise you to buy my book. No, I think that's kind of implied. You know, I also hate it when people post, where do I get this? You know, I post a picture of my book. Where do I get your book? Where do you get books?
I am
get it where books are.
By the number of people who are adept internet users and yet unable to Google.
Also, people who contact me through my website, the contact button. If you're on my website, I know the email came from there because it says to me, it tells me it came from my website. All of the books are right there. They're by links. So if you're asking me from that place where you came from, how do I get your books? I think you're just trying to kind of finagle yourself into my day, and I don't really respond well to that.
Yeah, definitely them wanting something from you, wanting to be seen. But you know, there was that Twitter account, I think it was like Harry My Cat Died, and just all of these One Direction fans trying to get the attention of Harry Styles by
sort of like, will you retweet this?
Yeah.
You know, for my cat. Oh no, I didn't know about that.
I think it's a very similar impulse.
Mm-hmm. I try to be nice. I think it's great that people bother to reach out to me, but sometimes it's the same way when you read a magazine and you see the dear People magazine. I just loved so and so on the cover, or dear People magazine. I wasn't sure it was appropriate to do this. I'm like, who sits down and writes letters to People magazine? So if you bothered to do it, then I appreciate that you spent that much time.
I'm really excited that you're writing a book about saying no, because I know that that was a big part of the first book, and that was really great and really useful. But I think it's this, I hate this word because I feel like it sounds quite, as a British person, I feel like other British people will roll their eyes when they hear me say this. No, I mean, so saying no and boundaries, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you hear this a lot, but I'm so impressed by how firm you are about setting those up. And I think it's possibly identifying what you want to safeguard and then working out how to safeguard it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like building a fence around your house. If you want to safeguard your house or your yard or whatever, it's demarcating the line of what's important to you and the place where other people can trample around and it doesn't bother you. And, you know, the first book, The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck, was really more philosophical and, like, giving you, you know, telling you that it's okay to say no to things and why it's okay. But people keep asking me, you know, okay, but how? How do I say no? And I'm like, I mean, there are lots of different ways. It's going to be almost a Mad Lib situation here. You know, fill in the, I'm sorry I can't come to your ex because this. And it's all about what reaction you want or don't want to elicit. It's about whether you're leaving the door open for a different manner of saying yes, but the no is for this thing. There's one, you know, that I call the no that sends a message. And so this book is going to be a very clear, example-filled compendium of ways to say no to all kinds of different things. And it's not just invitations to parties. It's saying no to job offers. Mm. You know, sometimes people get very anxious about the idea that they spent all this time going down this path, and then they decide they get the offer and they don't really want it and they feel bad. And I've known people that have upended their lives and accepted a new job just because they sort of felt like they couldn't not take it once it was offered to them. And I'm like, I understand that feeling, but I would now in my life, I would never feel.
I think this is how a certain kind of man gets dates. It's taking advantage of a woman's good nature and being like, well, there's every so often here, there's a viral story where a man takes a woman out for dinner, mm-hmm. and then when she doesn't want to go home with him, he mm-hmm. then like sends her a sort of like a PayPal request or something for the cost of the evening. Which characters, if any, do you think, but fictional characters in books, would most benefit from reading any of the No Fucks Given guides?
Oh, well, that's a really good question. I wish I had thought about that question in advance.
I wish I'd thought of it in advance.
Characters that could benefit from reading the No Fucks Given guides.
Maybe Marianne Dashwood could be with her. She's so... I love her dearly, but she's very sort of sentimentally led, and... Yeah. Ellen's got a bit more perspective about her.
I feel like you can take all of those sort of canonical, like, little women, and you could be like, one of them's really good at it, and, you know, two of them really need to work it out. Like, Beth probably needs to work it out, but Joe already gets it. It's easier for me to kind of look at popular culture and kind of say, you know, there are people who need to be able to not give so many fucks because they're wildly harried all the time. You know, certainly the casts of shows like The Real Housewives and those kinds of TV shows, I feel like these people have way too much time, energy, and money invested in the stupidest shit.
The national debt of Bolivia in fucks on those shows. Yes. Do you know, though, what you were saying about TV and whether that's going to be in your life and wanting it or not wanting it? All I want is a reality show that you do in the DR that's just chill. People are having pina coladas. Nobody tears anyone's hair out.
Yeah.
A nice, soothing, non-fighting, that kind of a show. Do you, when you watch those other reality programmes or, you know, just TV or things with tons and tons of conflict and drama, do you switch off and enjoy that and feel separate from it? Or do you find it stressful and think these people care way too much?
It depends on the show. I mean, I don't watch a ton of television these days. Part of it is, you know, we rely on the internet for our TV and it doesn't always work and blah, blah. I'm also usually preferring to read now that I have all this time to read. But there were shows like, for example, Breaking Bad, which is just a huge, huge hit in the U.S. and went on many, many seasons. And I watched several seasons of it. And then it just was like, I would come home from a really long day at work. This is when I was still working in publishing. And I was already upset and kind of depressed and, you know, and it was just not a show I wanted to watch in that mood because it was so, I like dark, but it was just like really depressing in many ways. And so I just stopped watching it because I just couldn't, it didn't really have to do with Bryan Cranston and co giving too many fucks. It was more like, this doesn't bring me joy. In the Marie Kondo world, you might say. So I decluttered my life of Breaking Bad. I told my husband he was allowed to just finish it without me.
Have you started to think of the way you were spending your time in that way? Or was Breaking Bad the first thing where you're like, actually, I don't have to care about this in the way that everybody expects me to?
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at the calendar to kind of figure out when it was that I stopped watching that show. But it was definitely toward the end of my time at Simon & Schuster, which was the time in my life where I was getting so unhappy and stressed out that I knew I needed to make a big change. And that might very well have been a moment where I was like, I don't need to watch this because I don't need to keep watching a TV show just because everybody else watches it and thinks it's great and it makes me feel bad and I don't want to do it. So I'm not going to. Which is sort of like when I was having a conversation about China patterns one time with one of my husband's relatives on the phone, and I just kind of in the middle of the conversation, I was like, I don't really want to talk about this. Can we talk about something else? Because it just occurred to me that I was going down this whole long road of like, I don't even like talking on the phone in general, but I was discussing China patterns and I just did not care. And so maybe it was brewing around that same time.
But I think, you know, as a reader and a fan, I really appreciate that you've been candid about your own mental health and that being a big inspiration in terms of writing the books. But also I think your inner, what seems like a very sensible way, is an act of self-preservation, quite private about it too. How much of it, when we talk about our own mental health, do you think that much of it was sort of environmental? Or I guess you possibly don't want to inspire everybody to quit their jobs, but maybe you do want to inspire people to think about changing their environment.
I definitely want to inspire and encourage people and give them a blueprint to do whatever it is they need and want to do to improve their life, their quality of life, their financial life, their success, you know, however you measure that. For me, it was looking for happiness. For me, it was looking to not be so beaten down and sad and nervous and panicky anymore. For other people, they could have other goals. And I do think I'm pretty public about, you know, my history with anxiety and depression and panic, eating disorders and all kinds of things that have shaped who I am, that I wish maybe I had known more about when they started happening to me, so maybe I wouldn't have suffered with them for so long. So I like to talk about that stuff, because if there's anything that I say that can help somebody else turn a corner, even if it's not being dispensed by a licensed medical professional, which I am not, there is my caveat, so then nobody can sue me for my advice, then I want to be able to do that. And for me, an environmental change being getting me out of the corporate world so that I could work for myself and answer to myself was huge. But my lifestyle change did not bring with it other different challenges that were difficult for my very controlling, very type A, very expectation managing persona. So in the end, it's not really the environment, I don't think quite as much, as it is changing the way you react to your environment and changing your relationship to your environment. And that's what Calm the Fuck Down is about. It's about knowing that bad shit happens to good people, and that life is full of unexpected and sometimes expected difficulties, and it's not all sunshine and roses. And when those things happen, there are better, and by better I mean healthier and more beneficial ways to handle them than freaking out. And I use freaking out in a broad sense. That could be anxiety and panic. It could be getting angry and kicking walls. It could be hiding under your bed. So Calm the Fuck Down is really about changing your relationship to the factors that stress you out, especially if, like many people, you cannot actually change those factors because you cannot leave your job, or it's going to be a long time before you can get out of whatever the situation is that is causing you the stress.
Huge thanks to Sarah. Calm the Fuck Down is out now, published by Quercus, and I promise that it is life-changing. It will give you the superpowers required to handle any situation. You can find Sarah across social media at MC Snugs with a Z, and I definitely recommend following her for her the excellent cat pictures. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for joining me, Biblio Buddies. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at ybooked@gmail.com. That's the letter Y, booked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next time for more epiolatry. And if you don't know what that means, don't look it up at work.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.